Okay, well, that's easier to write, I guess, than say. Well, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity, especially since Rick and Paul have done more than their fair share of conference organizing over the years. This talk is going to be computational, so I guess I don't know whether it was intentional or not, but it seems that the first talks in the morning are that way. And I'll be talking about some work that some of which is joint with Dan Duggar, and other parts are joint with Mike Hill. And let me put up a few names here on things that are, just to get these out of the way. So there's some closely related work of Hu, Creech, and Ormsby, and I guess there'll be a talk later this week about some of that. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about atom spectral sequences, and they've done a lot with Adams-Novikov spectral sequence, and also they have some work on convergence of these spectral sequences, which I won't talk about at all today. Who else do I want to mention? All of this stuff is really based on some fundamental computations of Vygotsky about motivic cohomology. And two other names I would mention are Morel has done some work on stable motivic homotopy groups. And also, I would sort of like to give special mention to Bob Bruner, who has been a great resource for me with lots of computational details in the classical case, and so I can help us figure out what's going on here. Okay, so let me start off with a little bit about motivic homotopy theory, just to get us up to speed on what I'm talking about. And the basic idea is to make a homotopy theory of algebraic varieties or schemes. Okay, so you start with smooth schemes over some fixed base. Okay, and we're just working with smooth schemes here. We're not looking at things with singularities. That's a whole different subject that that we won't even get into at all. And for the fixed base, I really have three things in mind. I have spec C, or an algebraically closed field of characteristic zero, and then spec R, as in the title. And also, I guess I'll mention this one, spec Z. And of course, this one is sort of the universal base, right? So when you're talking about things over spec Z, you're really talking about results that'll apply over any base. Okay. And those are the only cases that I'll be thinking about. And there's lots of interesting things to say about other fields, but I won't get into that at all. Okay, so you start with these smooth schemes, and the first problem that you run into when you try to do homotopy theory is you don't have enough gluing constructions for schemes. So there's this long story involving simplicial pre-chiefs. And what this allows you to do is it gives you a language to make formal gluing constructions or homotopy colimit constructions. Okay, so now you have a better category in which to think about homotopy theory. But there's a problem, which is that when you did this, when you allowed these formal gluing constructions, you kind of broke some relations that you'd really like to have. And so the first thing you have to do is restore some relations. And in particular, you say that a Nisnevich square is, you sort of declare it to be a homotopy pushout. You kind of add that relation back into the homotopy theory. And what Nisnevich means is not so important. You can just think about a Zariski cover. So X is a scheme, it's got a smooth scheme, it's got a cover by two pieces, and there's the intersection, and then if you glue the two things along their intersection, you get X back again. Okay, so that's one thing. And then the other thing that you have to do is, or you want to do, is introduce algebraic homotopies. And so you declare that these projection maps from X cross A1 down to X, you declare them to be weak equivalences. Okay? And in a strict literal sense, these two relations generate everything that you generate Motivic homotopy theory. So everything that you'd ever want to prove in some sense comes back to these two facts. Okay, so you have a homotopy, you have model categories and all that good stuff, and a homotopy theory. And what I want to talk about is computing in this category. So let me mention some important objects. So there are spheres here. So first of all, there's the ordinary spheres are sitting inside of this theory, and I've decorated this thing with two subscripts because there's another kind of sphere, which is the punctured line. And then you want to be able to mix these things, so then you can define SPQ to be SP minus Q 0 smash Q copies of S 1 1. Okay? And then to get stable Motivic homotopy theory, you're going to stabilize with respect to all of these spheres. Okay, and because you've got this bigraded family of spheres, what that means is that everything is going to be internally bigraded. Is what's going to happen here in this theory. There's a strong analogy to equivariant homotopy theory or Zmod 2 equivariant homotopy theory, where there's two circles. There's a trivial circle and the sign representation circle, and the same thing happens in ROG graded equivariant homotopy theory. You have this the same kind of thing, and you have extra gradings running around. Okay, so that's a good analogy to keep in mind to understand what all of these indices are standing for. Okay, and then there are various comparison functors. So you can start with, you know, topological spaces or topological spectra or whatever, and then that's sort of sitting inside of Motivic homotopy theory, and I put it in here in the universal case. It's sitting inside of all of them, and in particular the universal case. And then you can extend scalars. And if you have a smooth scheme over Z, then you can, you know, tensor up and get a smooth scheme over R, and then do that again and get to schemes over C. Okay, but then there are some other things that you can do here. Here you can then realize this thing. See, a complex variety, a complex scheme, you can take these sort of underlying topological space, and you can get back to topology. And in fact, this is the identity, all right? So there's a retract phenomenon going on here, okay? And then here, you can do something a little fancier. Here, you can actually get an equivariant space out of a real variety by looking at the complex point. You take the complex points of a real variety, you'll get a space, and conjugation will give you a Zmod 2 action, so you get an equivariant space there. And then here, there's the forgetful functor that forgets the Zmod 2 action. And then there's one more here, which is you can take fixed points and get back to topology also. Okay. So one of the main points of this diagram is that if you make computations here in Motivic homotopy theory versus spec R, you can get a lot of information about equivariant homotopy theory. So if you don't care at all about Motivic homotopy theory, but you do care about equivariant homotopy theory, this talk is still interesting to you because of this. And one of the main points I want to make is that computations here, surprisingly maybe, are actually easier than computations here. And you can detect a lot of stuff here, up here where computations are easier. And I'll get more into that later, specifically what I mean about being easier. Okay, so the subject I'm going to think about specifically today is, you know, stable homotopy groups of the sphere spectrum. So maps between stable spheres, right? That's what I'm talking about. And there are a few different approaches that you might take. So the first thing that you could try, sort of the most naive and sort of historically the oldest, is what I would call geometric constructions. And what I'm thinking here are way back to the methods of Toda, okay, all the way back to the sort of very beginning. And what do I mean specifically about this? So there's classical constructions of eta, nu, and sigma. There's brackets. You can produce all kinds of elements using Toda brackets out of other elements. And the other main tool that Toda used was the EHP sequence. So these two things work just fine for us, but the problem is that the theory of vibrations in motivic homotopy theory is not really well enough understood. And this, the EHP sequence really relies on some things about vibrations. And so, unfortunately, we don't really have this tool available to us. And that's just kind of how it works. Okay, so let me give you some examples of these two things. I won't spend much time. You can actually do quite a bit along these lines. And the nice thing about this approach is that it will work over here, over spec Z. So what are the next few things I'm going to say are true sort of in every motivic homotopy theory. And the other results I'll talk about later, there's no way they would ever work in that level of generality. Okay, so there's a couple of interesting guys that I'll give names to. So there's the twist map on S11 / S11, and that has a name epsilon. And that guy is really important because it comes up in commutativity relations. So if you have an alpha in stable pi AB and a beta in stable pi CD, then the commutativity relation between alpha and beta looks like this. Okay, and that's not so surprising. It's not so hard to see why. What's going on here? Well, when you pass an SAB past an SCD, what you have to do is you have A minus B trivial circles have to get swapped past C minus D trivial circles, and so that's this term. But then you also have B S11s that have to get switched with D S11s, and that's this term here. Okay, so that factor there. So that's not so surprising that you see that. But that shows you well that this guy Epsilon is a pretty interesting character. There's another guy. That I'll call rho. That's the inclusion of plus or minus 1 into A1 minus 0. And, you know, the way these schemes work, maps are kind of rigid. You can't do an algebraic homotopy of this to the constant map. There aren't any sort of scheme maps there to algebraic maps to do that. And so that's actually non-trivial. And this is like the inclusion of the fixed points into the sine representation circle. Okay, that's exactly what to think about that. Okay, and then you can do algebraic versions of the Hopf constructions. You can take multiplication on A1 minus 0 and use that to get eta. And you can do a fancy version of quaternionic multiplication and use that to produce an element. Well, let me give these degrees. So this is in pi 1, 1. And then there's a nu that you can do with sort of a quaternionic type thing to get an element in pi 3, 2. And then you can do something with octonionic multiplication and get something in pi 7, 4. Okay, so those are the basic things that you can write down kind of naively this way. And then you can go a little bit further with brackets. And let me just give one example. So here's a bracket, and this is contained in pi 8, 5, if you add up the weights, you'll find that it comes to 5. Here you have weight minus 1. So this guy's in time minus 1, minus 1. So here you have weight minus 1. Here you have weight 0. And here you have weight 4. And so that adds up to 5. And it turns out that you can show geometrically that both of these products here are 0. So this bracket's well defined. Now there's a problem here. Classically, there's a name for sort of like the guy that's in that, but its name is epsilon classically, and obviously you don't want to call that here, so I'll just sort of leave it blank. But the point that I'm making is that you can completely generally construct sort of the motivic version of epsilon with this sort of at this level. And this is only one example of the many types of bracket things that you can do. Okay, so you can do this, and it gets very technical very quickly, and obviously you won't really get too far just doing things at this level. So we'll stop with the naive geometric constructions there, and we'll actually use some technology. So it's possible to set up and compute with an atom spectral sequence over spec C and also over spec R, basically because of the fundamental computations that Vygotsky made allows you to do that. He's made some cohomological computations that allow you to get started, and that's what completely fails up there. That's what completely fails over spec Z or some arbitrary base schemes. I'm not sure you'd really ever expect to be able to say the precise cohomological statements that you'd need to compute there. Okay, so let me tell you what it was that Vygotsky computed. I'm going to write this theorem down sort of really, really, really simply and make it look like no big deal, but of course this is very hard work to actually do this. So M2, well, that's the name for the motivic cohomology of a point. And remember, everything's bigraded here, right, because of the bigraded family of spheres. So this is not too hard to describe. But it's not so simple as in topology, right? You actually get some cohomology of a point, and here the degree of tau is 0, 1. Okay, so that's the first thing that he did. And the second thing is that he described the Steenrod algebra of all cohomology operations. Okay, so you have operations square 2k, and these even ones have degree 2kk, and then you also have the odd ones, and their degrees are a little bit different, 2k plus 1, comma k. No, I didn't. Everything here is F2 cohomology. I'm just working with. So this there should be an F2 semicolon F2 in here. But absolutely everything will be with F2 coefficients. It turns out that at the odd primes, things work very similarly to the classical situation, sort of tensor something. And but over F2, there's lots of new exotic phenomena. So that's why I'm focusing on that. Is that your question? You asked it. Sorry. Is that your? Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. I haven't thought about that. I haven't thought much about that. I have some ideas, but I don't think I want to get into exactly what. Okay. Okay. So you have these operations, and then. And then the only relations you need are versions of the Edem relations, and they look like this. Did I get this right? Okay, so this looks just like the classical Edem relations, except for this little factor in here, and I put tau to the question mark, which sounds a little bit vague, but actually it's not at all hard to figure out what power of tau you'll need. Basically, you just do the bookkeeping, you count up your weights here, and you see if you ever have a term where the weights don't balance, you insert a tau to make the weights balance. So it's actually not hard to see. And you'll only ever need a 0 or a 1 here. Okay. So and for one example, that'll sort of explain to you the whole story. So there's classically, there's a relation square 2 is square 3 square 1. Over here, you have weight 1 plus 1, you have weight 2 over here. Over here, you have weight 1 plus weight 0, you only have weight 1 over here. There's a mismatch in the weights, and in fact, the motivic Adem relation looks like that with a tau inserted, and so on and so forth. So it's actually easy to figure out what's going on with the Adem relation. Okay. Well, I guess maybe I'll just squeeze this down here because I want to pull the projector down. You can completely compute, well, completely. I mean, you can compute as far as you want. The E2 term, the X over this standard algebra A, and maybe we should really call it A upper C, right? So you can compute this as far as you want with the May spectral sequence. And this turns out to actually be surprisingly easy. See, what happens over here is that you can convert this description into a Milner basis description. And what will happen is you'll get some factors with taus in them. But all of those factors with tau turn out to have higher May filtration. And so when you start off the May spectral sequence, you don't have anything. You just basically, you start with the classical May spectral sequence. It's the same thing, but then the differentials change. But anyway, the point is that the fact that you can start with the classical one means that you can do this. Okay, so let's take a look at what we get. I think maybe the chalk dust is interfering. Hopefully it's warm. Yeah, it's on, so it's warming up here. Slowly coming into focus. Okay, so that's what you get. Now, if you are familiar with the classical Adam spectral sequence, you'll see lots and lots of familiar things. And in fact, the first thing to note is that the stuff that's in black, the dots that are in black are precisely the classical May spectral sequence on the nose, classical X groups on the nose. So if you invert tau, you just get the classical X over A. And black dot stands for copies of M2 that survive tau, inverting tau. There's lots of stuff in red, and those are copies of M2 mod tau, which don't survive when you invert tau, right? And so the red stuff is sort of the new interesting things. Okay, so what do you see here? Well, the first thing you see is this infinite tower of H1, powers of H1. So that's the very first phenomenon that you see, and that's actually not so surprising. You can actually see that geometrically with eta. You can see that the arbitrary powers of eta are non-zero, and that's showing up there. This diagonaling, and then you see lots and lots of these red arrows, or red these infinite H1 towers. Okay, so you see these H1 towers, and that's new. And in fact, if you take any product of these guys, H1, C0, D0, E0, G. And let's put P in there, too, although that's not exactly an element, but what I mean, any sort of monomial in these symbols, right? What you get is you'll get something non-zero. Okay, so that's explaining, it's actually explaining all of the towers on this, all the red arrows. Every single red arrow on this picture is explained by that. And the way that you can prove this is by looking at, you can compute over A of 2 completely, and you see over A of 2 that these things are non-zero, and so therefore they must be non-zero here also. So this I've done completely over spec C computed with A of 2. So you actually see all of that stuff. There's more here. That's the next page out further. And this is probably a little bit further than I really should have gone, maybe. But anyway, but there's a reason that I went this far, because in this range in here, you start to see some new stuff. I don't know how well the colors are showing up, but there's some blue dots that show up right around here. And those are tau squared torsion classes. Okay? And there's one green dot there, which is a tau cubed torsion. Okay? So then you're seeing things like H0G squared, H2G squared, things of that sort that are sort of somehow even more exotic. And again, these are explained by A of 2 computations. Again, you can see these are non-zero in A of 2, so you know they have to be non-zero here. There's this nice little H1 tower here, but it terminates there after 7 steps. All these red arrows you see everywhere, right, from the products of C0, D0, E0, G. And then things kind of peter out around here because I got tired of making this chart. I mean the subit generated by square 1, square 2, square 4. Yeah, exactly. I don't know that a TMF type thing exists over spec C, but I do know what its homotopy will be if it does exist because of those sorts of computations. Okay. All right. So there's one. Yeah. That's not so easy to describe. You should ask Poe what that is. She has an answer. But you have to do it to complete. It kind of doesn't. So it's not like a nice simple geometric thing. Okay. All right. So there's one sort of structural theorem. That I'd like to state here. There is an injection from the classical X groups into these X groups over spec C, but it's not the one that, I mean, there is one that's sort of obvious, but there's a non-obvious one, and it takes something of it takes HI to HI plus 1, okay, and then it preserves all of the higher structure. So this is a map of E infinity things or whatever. It preserves the Massey products and the squaring operations and so forth, so that you can actually figure out what's going where. And then it takes, it's sort of funny. It does this funny degree shift, right, because of this sort of relation. It takes something in degree ST, and my degrees on all of these X charts will always be S will be the stem and T, or I'll have stem comma filtration. Okay, so everything is referring to stem and infiltration. I won't be talking about any internal degrees. And it takes something classical in degree ST to 2S plus T comma T, and then but there's a third grading motivically because of the weight, right? So this is the stem, the filtration, and then the weight is S plus T. So you have kind of complete control, understand what's going on here. And what's really happening, of course, is you're doubling the internal degree is what's happening, and then the weight is just half of that internal degree. So in a very predictable way. So this is actually this is kind of a surprising surprising fact. And I'll talk later in Spec R about why, how we know this is true. But this explains a lot of interesting things that we see back here. So let's see, I made a list of... Okay, so first of all, what about that H1 tower? Well, classically, there's the H0 tower. And then when you apply this injection, so you have to get an H1 tower. This is one, another way, maybe a sort of not the best proof of this. There's more naive ways to see this H1 tower, but it's consistent with that. Classically, there's an element pH2, and what that's saying is that H3G has to be non-zero, and there it is. It's not classical, so it's in red, but H3G, sure enough, is non-zero. What else? There's this little guy here, this H1 squared D1. Classically, that's zero, but here it's non-zero. That's because H0 squared D0 classically is non-zero, and so that tells you H1 squared D1 has to be. Can I do that? Yeah. And then there was this funny tower of H1s that terminated here, and that's also described, right? You have H0 to the 7th, H4 classically, and then here you'll have H1 to the 7th, H5. So you actually get a lot of stuff out of this theorem. You get almost everything that you see on this chart from by doing A of 2 computations. And by using this theorem, you get almost every single, those two strategies detect almost every single thing on this chart. The only class that it doesn't detect, or I haven't figured out how it detects or whatever, is that guy right there. That one guy right there. It's non-zero, and it doesn't seem to fit into either of these either of these two parts. So I don't really have a good explanation for why that one right there. On zero. I guess I should say something about the other colors on this chart. The green lines are just H2 multiplications. I just put them in green to help see things a little better. The magenta lines are saying that, like for example, this one is saying that there's an H0 extension here, but it doesn't hit the generator. It actually hits tau times the generator. So the relation here is that H0 squared H2 equals tau H1 cubed. And similarly all over the place here, there's lots of places where the H2 or H0 multiplication hits tau times the generator, and then there's actually even an H1 in there where that happens. Okay, so there's lots of new stuff in this chart, and then you can this is just the E2 term. You can compute the differentials reasonably well by mostly just by comparison to classical stuff, and you can actually sort of work out E infinity, at least for this page. I haven't thought precisely about the second page, whether you can really do that, whether you can get all the differentials or whether there are some unanswered things. But anyway, you can, more or less, you can actually run through the whole atom spectral scale. I won't talk about that today. Yeah, that's this one. That's this here. That's exactly. You use that basically. There are some exotic differentials that you have to deal with, and you do some ad hoc argument, and you figure it out. But you can do it. I guess is what I'm saying. All right. So that was fun, at least for me, to do that. And then the next thing, I think we're up to 4 now, is, let's take a look at the atom spectral sequence. Over R. And here things get quite a bit more complicated. Okay, so let's go back and talk about the fundamental cohomological computation. So again, this is also it's really the same theorem of Vygotsky. So now, the cohomology of a point with F2 coefficients gets more complicated. So there's still this tau in here, but then now there's another class rho, and that's actually the same rho that we talked about earlier. It's detecting that other rho, right? And so that's worse. So the degree of tau is 0, 1. The degree of rho is 1-1. But it's even worse than that because there's also squaring operations in the cohomology of the point. Okay, so that makes things a lot of fun. You're going to get hop algebroids as opposed to hop algebras here at the atom spectral sequence and have to deal with that extra complication. Okay, so the picture that I draw is something like this. Right, so this is the range in which sort of normal XY coordinates, right? This is the range in which there's a copy of F2 everywhere in this range, and then there's zeros everywhere else. Okay. So earlier I said that these motivic computations are easier than the classical computations, and here is precisely the point. You can look at the ROG graded cohomology, ROZ mod 2 graded cohomology of a point. And it's even worse. Okay, so not only do you have this big thing up here in positive degrees, but you also have another wedge of elements down here with sort of a nasty divided polynomial structure. It's really kind of yucky to deal with. Well, and that will make your computation sort of even harder right from the very beginning. Here we don't have that, and so we're in much better shape. And you know, you won't, what this is saying is that you're not going to detect everything about equivariant homotopy theory with motivic homotopy theory, but you'll get a lot of interesting stuff. Okay, so and I want to talk about one example of the cohomology of the cofiber of 2, right? So of RP2. And I'm thinking just the classical topological RP2 that's sitting inside of motivic homotopy theory. Well, you think, how different could that be? It's sitting inside, so I mean, why am I even bothering? We all know what the cohomology of RP2 is. But there's something really interesting that happens here, and we'll need this fact later, so this is a good time to mention it. So what does the cohomology look like? Well, you have a generator, say x, of degree 0, 0, and then you have another generator, y, of degree 1, 0, as you'd expect. And you have a squaring operation, square 1 of x is y. But here's where the funny thing happens. Classically, it doesn't make sense. A square 2 vector, there's no place for it to go. But motivically, square 2 has degree 2, comma 1. And so when you go 2 comma 1, right here there is something. And sure enough, square 2x is rho times y. Okay? So what this is saying is that that 2 is it, 2 is not detected by h0. 2 is detected by h0 plus rho h1. Okay? So what is detected by h0? 1 minus epsilon. Is detected by H0. Okay? And actually the same thing happens for the topological eta in pi 1-0 and the topological nu in pi 3-0. You get another squaring operation and you have to just keep track of these things because it's sort of surprising. Okay, and later on there'll be an H0 plus rho H1 showing up and that'll sort of explain why it's there. Okay, so there's the cohomology of a point, and then let's describe the Steenrod algebra over R. So you have the same generators, the squaring operations, and then you have the same Edem relations. But actually, they get a lot more complicated. The Edem relations have a whole nother family of terms, a whole nother sort of sum. But all of these guys are all with extra rho divisible terms. So there's all factors of rho in front of all those extra terms. And I don't want to be precise about what those extra terms are, both because it's sort of annoying to write it down, but also for a philosophical reason, which is that the way I'm going to get at X over R is with a Rho-Bochstein spectral sequence, so that those extra terms don't actually matter. If you filter by powers of Rho, those extra terms go away, and so they just don't enter into the picture. So the Rho-Bochstein spectral sequence looks like this. It starts with X over C, because that's the without if you mod out by the extra powers of Rho, you just get these other adem relations that we already talked about. So that's why you're starting with X over C, and then you adjoin a Rho, right? That's the E2 term, and then that will converge to the X groups over R. Okay. So the name of the game here then is to actually compute this Bochstein spectral sequence. I don't have a chart for any of this stuff. There's way too much stuff. It gets way too muddy to actually try to do that. I have tried to make a chart just for A of 1 computations, and already there it's just sort of barely possible to kind of fit everything on the page. So the way that I'm gonna sort of represent this stuff is just with this chart again. But you have to remember that you have this sort of all of these sort of multiples of Rho also. So an element like this guy here, there's H3 squared and it has weight 8, and here there's Rho, H3 squared has weight 7, Rho squared, H3 squared has weight 6, weight 5, weight 4, weight 3, weight 2. So you kind of have to keep track of the fact that every single one of these dots has an infinite tower of Rho's going off to the left of it with decreasing weights at each step. And I don't know any better way than just to sort of imagine that those lines are there. Anyway, okay. So the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm actually going to compute precisely what happened, the Rho torsion free part of this of X over AR. Okay? In other words, what's the stuff that sort of doesn't support or get hit by any differentials in the Rho-Bochstein spectral sequence? Okay? And I actually can do this pretty easily in advance, which is a huge help later on, because then it'll eliminate lots of possibilities for what differentials might be. Okay? So this is, well, first of all, of course you have that. And then the answer is surprisingly simple. What you get is another copy of this classical X guy here, but again with that degree shift that we saw, where it's not a copy of this in the obvious way. It's a copy of this in sort of a non-obvious way, where H0 is corresponding to H1, and H1 is corresponding to H2, and so forth. So that's precisely what the Rho torsion-free, precise description of the Rho torsion-free stuff. Okay, and I can actually this theorem is surprisingly easy to prove. So you can look at the dual motivic steamrod algebra, and there's a nice description of this. And this goes back to Vavadsky. Okay, so that looks a lot like the dual steamrod algebra for primes greater than 2, okay, where you have some taus and some xis. But there's a difference, because classically at odd primes, these tau I squared are 0. Here, they're not 0. Okay. And this is obviously the source of a lot of complication. But if you invert Rho, you see you've got this term here. And so tau k plus 1 is actually describable in terms of other elements. And so if you invert rho, then what you get is, this is, should be M2, not F2. You get a polynomial thing on tau 0, and then tensor with, actually, let's do it this way. It's tensor over F2 with this. And if you look at the co-product formulas, you see that, in fact, these guys don't interact at all. So it really is a tensor product. Okay? This is precisely the classical dual with the degree shifts, because this guy, instead of having degree 1, degree 3, this has degree 2, 1, and that has degree 6, 2. So there's a doubling. That's where the doubling of the degrees is coming in. This guy over here, then you have to worry about, and you see that polynomial thing there, and you think, well, I mean, shouldn't there be something coming into play because of that? But it turns out that this guy here, this is a genuine Hopf algebroid. So if you look at the difference of the two units on tau, remember, I erased it just now, but remember tau supported the square 1, and so that's telling you that the difference of the units is non-zero, and what you get is rho tau 0. That's precisely the square 1 of tau is rho, right? You can see that right there. But again, rho is invertible here, and so you're also hitting tau 0, and you're sort of hitting everything, and then there's no cohomology from this term at all. And so all you're left with is the cohomology from this piece, and that's the classical stuff there. Okay, so that's the whole proof. It's not even it's not even so bad. Okay, so that tells you that's telling you what classes are not hit by any differentials or not truncated by different. Let me say it this way: everything else either supports a differential or is truncated by a differential. Okay, so that's a good start. And in fact, it's better than a good start. It's actually fantastic. It turns out that's really all you need to know for a long, long, you can actually compute a long, long way now just by sort of process of elimination with this fact here. Okay, so for example, the very first differential you get is that d1 of tau is rho h0. And you can just argue, there are maybe other easier ways of seeing this, or maybe this is a pretty easy way, but tau is not rho torsion free, so it either, you know, it's either hit or it's truncated, and this turns out to be the only thing that it could possibly, it can't be hit by anything. This is the only possible thing that could happen to tau and to h0. You sort of have to have that. Okay? And similarly, you have for the same sorts of reasons, for the same reason, d2 to the k of tau 2 to the k has to hit rho 2 to the k tau 2 to the k minus 1 hk. Okay, so well, that's the zero line, I guess. And then you can, you can actually work this all out just kind of carefully working your way through the chart, checking element by element. And I'll just give you some examples of things that happen to kind of give you a flavor of tau to the fourth H1 has to hit tau H2 squared. So now what I'm doing here is I'm writing elements in this notation that makes them look like they're decomposable, but they're not. This is an indecomposable, right? Tau doesn't survive. So this guy here is an indecomposable, so you kind of have to be careful about the notation a little bit, about what's decomposable and what's not. But that tau h2 squared, that's an indecomposable right there, and that's going to give you something in pi 6.3, something sort of new in pi 6.3. Okay, let me write down a couple more just to show that there are some sort of non-obvious things that happen. Again, just process of elimination. Tau to the fourth, H1 squared, has to hit D7, has to hit rho to the seventh, C0, and just one more, D15 of tau to the eighth, H1 cubed, hits rho to the 15th, D0. So it's looking like a real mess, and it is a real mess. There's all kinds of just sort of strange, arbitrary formulas that come out of this. You can go a long, long, long way, and eventually you get to the following problem. There are two elements here on the 4 line, and you know that they have to hit, so they can't survive because they weren't truncated by anything on the 3 line, but you don't know what they, you don't know, well, I don't know what they hit. They, well, I sort of, I know that they have to hit these two things. Where's tau n? N is right here, right? So you can see, like, we've gotten pretty much as far as we really wanted to go anyway, right, with this approach before it breaks down, right? And I haven't done anything. All I've done is bookkeeping, right? I've used this theorem and this idea, and I've just done the bookkeeping, and this is how far. And I don't know how to resolve, well, I think I know how to resolve this. What you have to do is you have to use a bracket to say that, oh, this one of these guys is killed by a small power of rho, and so therefore it's got to be this one that hits it because that one will give a longer differential or something. Anyway, something like that. You know, at some point you say, well, why bother, right, because it's enough already. But anyway, you can get enough to completely compute the 1 line, the 2 line, and the 3 line. Okay, so I have a complete description of what survives there. There are some surprising things. You see things like this on the 1 line. There's the HI, the HKs themselves. And then there's these sort of these predictable powers of tau times HKs that survive on the 1 line. On the 2 line, you have the only indecomposables is that tau H2 squared and things related to it. That's really the only phenomenon that occurs is indecomposable on the 2 line. On the 3 line, the indecomposables are more complicated, and so some permanent cycles on the 3 line are... Well, let me just write down one. Tau the fifth H2 squared H4 survives. That's kind of the weirdest one that ends up that survives. I mean, and then there's infinite families of these things, but they're kind of predictable. That's kind of there's one. So anyway, I'm saying that already things are looking kind of weird, but there you have it. Okay. So basically, you can compute this rho Bochstein spectral sequence, up to a point. I mean, you know, far enough, right? To be satisfied that you've done something. But there's another complication, which is that the rho Bochstein spectral sequence, of course, can hide some extensions. And I want to talk about some of these for a specific reason that you'll see in a minute here. So let's take a look at this guy tau squared H2, which we know survives, right? In fact, it's killed by rho to the fourth. Okay. Well, there's a bracket here for that guy. You see, remember, tau squared hits this product, so and it's tau squared H2 that's in the it's in the Massey product. So that's it's not surprising, but that's a useful fact, because then you can do a shuffle, and I mean, that's something that you'd expect to be zero, right, at first glance, but if you shuffle this, what you get is rho squared times tau, that tau H2 squared thing there. Turns out there's a hidden extension here that this thing equals that. Okay, and then similarly, you can do the same kind of shuffle to show that H1 times tau H2 squared equals rho times C0. So what's happening over here? Let's try to make sense of this. H1 times tau squared H2, it's right here, but it has weight 0, right? And then, it has weight 1, sorry. It has weight 1 right here, and then rho squared times this tau H2 squared. Tau H2 squared is weight 3, weight 2, weight 1, so there's that formula in weight 1, right? Here, there's H1 times tau H2 squared. That has weight 4 right here. Well, that's rho C0. That's weight 4 there. Right? So you see those things. Okay. All right, so there's a reason that I want to talk about these guys here. There are these X groups over R, like all X groups, have an action of the theorem algebra. They have these squaring operations that are built into them. Okay? And you can use these things to great effect. For example, you know that H0 times H1 is 0. That one really is 0. And if you apply square 1 to it, what you get is this predictable, already known relation there, way there, down there in the 3-stem with that magenta H0 extension. But if you apply square 2 to this relation, and you work this all out, what you get is H0 to the 4th H3 plus tau squared H2 times H1 to the 4th. Okay, classically, that's just disappearing, and you're getting H0 to the 4th H3, which is a familiar, important relation. But we have these hidden extensions here. H1 times tau squared H2, that gives you a tau H2 squared, then multiply by another H1, and you get a rho C0. And so what you're getting here is that H0 to the 4th H3 plus rho cubed times H1 squared C0. And this is the reason that I wanted to go through these hidden extensions, is to point out to you that H0 to the 4th H3 on these X to R groups is non-zero. There's a weird hidden extension up here, and then there's H1 squared C0, which is non-zero. It's got weight 7, 6, 5, weight 4, and that's the weight 4 that you'd expect. That's a pretty strange thing, right? And I should say that this is surviving the Adams Becker sequence, the differential. Okay, what I'm claiming here is that sigma, or 2-primary, sigma does not have order 16. At least with respect in this thing here, it has order 32. Okay, that's not expected, right? And it brings up all kinds of questions, like, what is the image of J? Now, it's the sort of thing that you figured would just be the same, or you'd figure you'd know, but this, casts a lot it's a bizarre thing. The same thing happens. This is over R. Yeah, over C it is 0. Yeah. The same thing happens to H4. This is I think it involves E0 or something. I wrote it down here somewhere. Rho the 7th H1 the 5th E0. Okay. So unfortunately it's non-zero, but it's sort of complicated what's going on. Okay. And another problem here is that this wreaks havoc now with the Adams periodicity operator. The Adams periodicity operator, relies on the fact that this product is zero. And so I don't even know what's happening along the top edge there. PH1 doesn't survive, by the way. PH1 supports a differential. Tau PH1 survives. it looks calculationally like p squared does make sense, and that maybe there's like a p squared periodicity up along the top edge, and I guess I don't know precisely, but anyway, my time is up. There's all kinds of unanswered questions here, and let alone differentials in the atom spectral sequence. I mean, there's a whole other thing here, but this gives you some flavor and some concrete new and I think surprising results out of all this stuff. Okay, thank you. Yeah. I don't know. What's A to J? Oh, H1HJ. Yeah, H1HJ will exist. I mean, the HIs all exist, so H1HJ will exist. And it'll be one of these torsion-free, one of these row torsion-free things. Oh, I see. They survived. I don't know. Yeah, right. Okay. So, I mean, that's a good question, of course. And, you know, you get this far and you stop and say, well, have I said anything about that? And, well, originally we'd hoped that it just over spec C that the weights would tell you something, right? This guy has weight 16, and unfortunately, there's lots of weight 16 stuff, and the same thing happens out for H5 squared. There's lots of weight 32 stuff. So spec C really doesn't help you at all. I had this fantasy that maybe when you compute the row torsion, what you'd find is that like maybe this guy has some sort of low power, truncated, and they can't hit anything of higher, but we've shown that these guys are row torsion free, so that's not telling you anything either. Not so surprisingly, I don't have anything to say on that subject. I wish I could give you more, but obviously.
So you mentioned that over R, you don't have a period of the atom period violated, and it becomes something that appears to be P squared.
Yeah. That's a guess. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a simpler spectrum over set R that would exhibit something akin to the 16-fold period?
I don't know. I mean, the K-theory spectrum over spec R is going to have 8-fold periodicity still. So it's not that, but I don't know.